I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Growing up in cities shouldn't be difficult. Good cities have ample sidewalks, parks, unmatched cultural opportunities, and plenty of places to play and explore. But according to David Driscoll, UNESCO Chair of Growing Up in Cities at Cornell, that is increasingly not the case. He's working with students around the world to find out from them how cities can be better places for kids, and he's with us today to tell us what he's learned. We'll also find out how Money Magazine chooses its annual list of best places to live and about the pleasures and benefits of city walks. That's today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. David Driscoll is a practicing planner with extensive experience in community participation, comprehensive planning, and community design. David is UNESCO chairman of Growing Up in Cities and a lecturer at Cornell. He is founding principal of Community Planning Collaborative. David, you say that cities are failing to meet the needs of young people and their families. Why?
Where to begin? There's a lot of different ways. One is we've basically been systematically removing places for young people in the city environment. We've been creating places that are programmed and controlled, but a lot of the places that you or I might remember from our childhood that were our favorite places, places that we wanted to get away to and explore and figure out, you know, the world and who we are in relation to it, those places don't exist anymore. And if they do, they're not, we don't allow young people to go there. We just actually did some work this last few months in Queens, New York, in the community of Jackson Heights. And the young people there had gone through a process of documenting the places that they have available to them to play. And what was shocking to me and some of the other people involved was the number one place that they go to where they feel safe and welcome is McDonald's. And they're, you know, because for the price of an ice cream cone, they can sit there and chat with their friends. And the other places that were available to them were the sidewalks where they're not allowed to play, garden areas behind their apartment buildings where a lot of them have regulations now that children aren't allowed, and a local park where for them it's if you go there, you're going to eventually get into drugs and crime, so they stay away from that place. So, and then they started doing some research about the places that used to be in Jackson Heights. And there used to be a ballpark, and there used to be an amusement park, and they interviewed older people who talked about playing in the street and playing in the gardens and playing in the vacant lots. And these kids started getting pretty angry about the lack of places for them. Every place that even was still available to them, they're not allowed to go. They're pretty much regulated out of the environment, and they're expected basically to be enrolled in summer school and enrolled in YMCA programs and enrolled in places that remove them from the city in a lot of ways and take them into controlled environments.
How did we get here, David?
A lot of ways that we approach development in which really the city development is seen as an economic activity. It's to create money. We don't really regulate in terms of trying to create places for young people. We create tot lots and things like that, but we don't really think holistically about young people in the city environment and what that means in terms of regulating land use. We also have a culture of liability and litigation and fear. You know, there's been a lot of incidents in the last, 10, 20 years that are widely publicized. And so a lot of people today have the sense that childhood is more dangerous and neighborhoods are more dangerous now than they were when we were young. But the actual fact is that they're not more dangerous. We just have the sense that they're more dangerous. So we pull back and we don't allow our kids to go outside.
How did you become interested in kids and cities?
That goes way back. I was involved in a planning consulting firm in Berkeley, California, and we had the opportunity to work on the downtown Berkeley general plan, or it was actually the master plan for downtown, and there was the opportunity to involve some of the high school students from Berkeley High in the process, and I got involved in that, and I just enjoyed it immensely. I saw the city in a totally new light in terms of listening to what young people were saying about the places that they liked and the places that they were afraid of. And I also just got excited about the very innovative ideas that they had of how to make the city a better place, not just for them, but for everybody.
You lead a UNESCO project called Growing Up in Cities. It's a global effort to involve young people in planning their cities. How do young people see cities differently than adults?
We've been working in a lot of different cities around the world, and typically we work in the lowest income areas of any city. And the thing that's always striking is young people are so much more tied to the local environment than adults are. I mean, we move around by car, by bus, or by bike, however it is in the local area where we live. We don't spend the whole day in the neighborhood. Young people do, and they see it at a much finer grain than adults typically do. So often they call attention to issues that I've been working with young people for quite a long time, and I don't see it, but they'll point out to you the way in which the sidewalk is positioned in relation to the bus stop, so it creates a hazardous situation. And they say, why can't we just move the sidewalk over there 50 yards? This was in Poland we were working, and these kids had such a practical solution that was going to make a difference in their life, and all it really required to fix it was a can of white paint. To me, the thing that strikes me all the time is that they just see things that we don't see. And the other thing we've noticed across we've now worked in about 20 different countries, and almost invariably what young people identify as priorities for improving the neighborhood for young people is completely different from what adults think the priorities are.
Give me a sense of their priorities.
Well, this is obviously a vastly different example than North America, but my first project I worked on growing up in cities was in a slum area of Bangalore, India. And we did interviews with local officials to ask them what they thought young people's priorities were, and they talked about sports fields and playgrounds. And then we went through about a two-month process of working with young people in the slum, documenting what was going on in the community and them identifying priorities. And their priorities were clean water and sanitation and very, you know, practical, real things. But they were carrying water 4 hours a day to bring it home and to help take care of the house. So for them, playgrounds wasn't on the agenda yet. They wanted to deal with some very practical infrastructure issues.
That oddly parallels a recent study that CEOs for Cities did with college-educated 25 to 34-year-olds in the U.S. And looking at the attributes that they seek in cities. And the very first attribute was clean and attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And then numbers 3, 4, 5 were green, safe, affordable.
Yep.
Again, very basic qualities of cities that really give lie to this notion that college-educated young people are looking for hip and gritty cities. Go back to the group of young people you were working with in Jackson Heights, and they recognize that these places have disappeared that their parents were able to play in. And what were their recommendations?
Well, they actually, last I met with them, they were organizing a petition drive to go to the co-op buildings where a lot of them live. And I don't know the exact figures in terms of who's living in these buildings. My initial thought was that this must be a lot of senior citizens, you know, who don't want noisy kids playing in the back area. But the kids said, no, about half of the people living in these buildings are kids. But they're not allowed to play in what was originally designed as a play area in the back area of the co-op building. So they were doing a petition to take around to their parents and other people in the building to allow young people to be able to play in what are basically the remaining green, safe areas in Jackson Heights, which are these beautiful backyard garden areas. They have some pretty practical recommendations. There's also a movement in New York City to try to make neighborhood schools play yards available to neighborhood children during the weekends and the evenings when they're typically, you know, padlocked.
Mm-hmm.
So there are remaining places in New York where kids can play, but they're not allowed to.
Have the young people that you've worked with talked at all about controlling their peers and ways to control their peers? One of the things that surely frightens adults off of allowing children to hang out in the gardens or other spaces is that they can be loud, they can be boisterous, some of them can be dangerous. Do young people talk frankly about that, and do they have any ideas for controlling their peers?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think in terms of the issue of youth crime, I think adults lose track of the fact that the people most affected by youth crime are young people themselves. So it's always on the agenda for discussions. They are concerned about it probably more than you or I or other adults are, because it directly impacts them on a daily basis. So they're very concerned about creating safe places. And I guess for me, it's what we're trying to do in Growing Up in Cities is to really recognize young people as partners for making cities better places, and that they're not just part of the problem, which some of the young people are, right, but they're part of the solution. They are essential to the solution. And then one of the things we've also been looking at is the research in terms of young people's engagement. When young people have the opportunity to make a change in their neighborhood, to have a positive environmental experience and doing something, not only does it develop a stronger sense of environmental stewardship and taking care of the place they live, but it also leads to more engaged adults who are going to be active in their community. And that really is what's required for creating safe cities and safer neighborhoods is people who are involved, people who are engaged, people who are having a commitment to taking care of the place they live. And these kids want to be part of that, and they're doing it. I mean, the kids in the South Bronx we worked with spent all summer trying to get a hold of a lot from the city parks department so they can create a community garden space, which for them is not just a green space to make the neighborhood more beautiful, but it's also a safe place that they can go and be productive. They don't want to go to the park and which isn't controlled, which isn't managed, which, you know, and be sucked into a world that they don't want to be a part of in terms mm-hmm. of drugs and crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, New York used to have play leaders and people stationed at parks who managed and facilitated play. Those people aren't there anymore.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up. I grew up in a city that also had what we call park commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
And the park commissioners, they always had one female, one male. They were high school, perhaps college students. And they would run the programs on the parks.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother happened to be a park commissioner. And so he was much older than I was. So I would, for 2 years, I actually spent the summer with him at the park he was assigned to, which happened to be at a public housing project.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much fun, and it was so safe, and there were never any problems. And it's by removing those people, we have lost a lot, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've left kids to fend for themselves in those environments. And I mean, the thing that's been striking in New York, I mean, parks are still a really important part of young people's lives. But when we did the last summer, we did a whole neighborhood environmental analysis in 6 neighborhoods. And the young people identified almost invariably the same park, both as their favorite place and their least favorite place. Depending on what time they went and who else was there,
really?
It could be a great place to be or it could be the most frightening place they'd ever been.
Hmm.
So, you know, these are real concerns to them. And there's, you know, a movement to try to, you know, increase funding for not just for parks development, but for managing the parks. And there's a group in the Lower East Side that we've been working with that's launched a program that the young people developed it, the idea. They call it the PIWI campaign, P-I-W-I, which is the Prove It With Improvements.
Huh.
And they spent this last summer working with one of their groups up in Upper Harlem, and they're going into parks and they're doing an assessment of what works for young people, and then they're actually making changes and they're cleaning it up and they're, you know, so they're reclaiming these places that in some ways have been lost. But they're doing it on their own, and they need adults who will partner with them and do the things that young people can't do. You know, they need financial resources, and they need, you know, regulatory responses and policy making
mm-hmm.
and things that they can't do themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But they want to be partners, and they want to make a change. This is a neighborhood that they're living in, and they care about, and they have a lot of pride in. We brought a whole group of them up to the Cornell campus last fall after they'd been working in the summer. I think the thing that struck some of my colleagues the most was the pride that these kids have about the neighborhoods. You know, they said, yeah, we know the South Bronx has a lot of problems, but we're proud of it. We're proud to be from the South Bronx. It's our neighborhood.
I like that. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is David Driscoll. He is the chairman of UNESCO's Growing Up in Cities, and he's at Cornell. Where is Growing Up in Cities, David, active?
It's active. Sometimes it's hard to know.
Yeah.
I think it's active in about 20 different countries now. We operate as a network of people. There's no, I mean, I'm, I guess, the closest to a central program office there is, but I'm not much of an office. I'm just me and some grad students who work on the project. We have people at the local level who decide that they want to do a project like this, and they basically use the methodology, and we have communication back and forth to sort of help them along, and sometimes we go out and do a workshop. But we have people at universities, in city government, in grassroots organizations, and they just have a commitment to working with young people as partners and hearing young people's voices and then supporting them and making change. So sometimes I get just an email saying, hey, we just finished a Growing Up in Cities project in Guatemala. I was like, oh, okay, I had no idea. But we have this 2 weeks ago, a young woman who graduated from Cornell went back to Sarajevo, where she's from. She launched a project there. They had their first workshop a couple weeks ago. There's a project starting up in Nairobi, in Sao Paulo, in Manila. There's a very active project throughout Canada in several cities there. There's a project starting up in Seattle, in Denver, in Alabama. Hmm. So it's very active right now. There is a lot of interest and concern about young people. And I think that a lot of adults are reaching the point where they realize we have to engage young people in this process as partners, and we have to really listen to what they're saying and what childhood was like for you and me growing up in a city 20, 30 years ago is not the same of what it is for them today. And we can't draw on that knowledge and think that we know what it's like to be young in a city.
Do you see significant differences in how children participate and their interest from nation to nation, city to city?
Well, there are differences. Certainly there's cultural differences in terms of, despite any culture difference, young women are typically not allowed to roam around the neighborhood as much as young men are. Mm-hmm. And that's a more severe restriction in some cultures than others. But the thing I think that's striking across all of these different cultures is the enthusiasm that young people have when they start working on a project like this. They really get into it. And the other is how important the natural environment is to young people. We had a project in Oakland, California. It was immigrant children from Mexico and Cambodia that were in an apartment complex in a very high crime neighborhood. Their parents didn't allow them to leave this apartment complex. So there was basically this play, well, it wasn't a play area, it was just a vacant area sort of in the central part of the apartment complex where there was one tree. And that tree showed up in every children's drawing. Hmm. They talked about it. It was such an important place. And the landlord of the building was about to cut it down because he was concerned that you couldn't see. He wanted sight lines for safety. So the group that was working there basically worked with him to come up with a design that would address some safety concerns he had but not get rid of the tree and actually create other sort of green space opportunities for these kids. Nature experiences in the natural environment, we know from the research on child development, are extremely important. And young people know it. They talk about it. And I think most adults, if you think back to places that were important to you, you start to remember how important those places were.
Mm-hmm.
Like we had kids in the South Bronx who took our researcher last summer across two fences trespassing into an area where there was literally like an 8-square-foot plot of grass. And that was their special place. That's where they went to get away from things.
It seems hard to get busy people involved in planning their communities in an informed way, I mean, in a deep
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
They oppose things, but in terms of developing productive plans to move a community forward, it's sort of hard to get people engaged. What techniques do you use, David, to get young people involved and collect informed opinion?
Mm-hmm. In terms of young people, we have a little advantage in that a lot of them are busy, but they tend to sign up for summer programs. So a lot of our partners we work with in, for example, New York, are running summer programs. The kids sign up for that, and this becomes enmeshed within the summer program that they do. So they're going out and doing, we do a lot. The methodologies we do, we start with a one-on-one interview, which the initial response from our community partners were like, oh, kids don't want to sit and do an interview. That's so adult. But it ends up being one of the most popular activities because they don't typically have the experience of an adult sitting down with them and listening to what they have to say for 45
mm-hmm.
minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it the Ask the Expert interview. They're the expert about their neighborhood, and we interview them about it. And then there's a series of photography activities. We do a framing exercise. They carry a frame out in the neighborhood, and they put it around things in the environment that tells them this is a good place or a bad place for young people.
Mm.
And they take a picture, which that helps them to look at the environment differently because they have to focus on something specific. We do walking tours with them, and then we do a mapping exercise where they basically start put their data together. And the whole approach of the project is that we see them as co-researchers, and we mm-hmm. use the language of that you're a researcher about this neighborhood, and mm-hmm. you're going to help understand what's going on here, and that all young people don't have the same experience. So not only is it about you having your say, it's about listening to what other young people are saying who are a different age from you or different gender or different cultural background, that we all have a different experience. And so we need to figure out what's working here for all of us and what's not working for some, and find out what our priorities are for making some changes.
What can we learn about how to include young people productively in the life of the city from growing up in cities and all that you've learned?
That young people want to be involved, I think, is a really important lesson. I think sometimes we think, well, who's going to want to do this? Kids aren't interested in doing research. They're not interested in, you know, being productive citizens. They just want to run around and play, or they're interested in being destructive. But that's not what we've experienced. There's a lot of interest and enthusiasm. I think the other is that these kinds of processes, we need to get past the point of seeing these as one-off special projects that happen for 3 weeks and then it's over. It needs to become embedded within the way that we work. And the rich thing in American culture and cities is that there's a tremendous number of really great nonprofit and community-based organizations. And a lot of them are working with young people at the high school age. And what we try to get them to do is to start working with young people at the middle school or even younger. Mm-hmm. And getting them involved and creating opportunities for them to be involved in what the organization's doing, and then and through that involved in what the community's doing. And then schools, obviously, is a place that we have a lot of work to do in terms of linking community activity to what's going on in schools, using the community as an educational environment, and using experiential education activities, which is what Growing Up in Cities really is. I mean, they learn a lot of different skill sets when they go out in the neighborhood and do these research activities. And they could be doing it in the school, but the school environment's proved to be one of the more difficult environments to do these kinds of things. One, because there's such an ingrained adult-student dynamic, which often isn't the healthiest dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
I had the experience last summer of going to one of the sites in New York, and it was a summer school program, and sitting in the classroom in the morning and just watching these kids, you know, every time the teacher turned around, they were doing things they weren't supposed to be doing. And actually sitting next to a kid who threatened to knife the kid next to him if he did that thing once more time. They then left the school building and went out into the neighborhood on a walking tour. And these kids the one kid who had just threatened to knife the kid is now skipping down the street chasing a butterfly and talking incessantly about the neighborhood and this building and the ghost stories that his aunt had told him. And, you know, it was really striking, the difference. And the dynamic with the teacher changed dramatically as soon as they were out of the school building. We could be taking kids out into the neighborhood or on a regular basis. And there's so many great organizations. These kids have now developed relationships with an old men's group that does a community garden project down the street.
David, your work is so interesting and I think very important. I appreciate so much your being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
David Driscoll is UNESCO Chairman of Growing Up in Cities. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Money staff writer Donna Rosato about why only cities with fewer than 300,000 people qualified for the magazine's annual list of best places to live in America. And we'll visit with Marianne McGinnis at Prevention Magazine about the simple joys and big benefits of city walks. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Each year, Money Magazine selects its version of the best places to live in the U.S. With us to talk about that list is Money staff writer Donna Rosato. Donna, how did you choose your best places to live?
Well, each year at Money Magazine, we've been doing our annual Best Places to Live survey for almost 2 decades. And each year, we set out with a little bit of a different criteria. And this year, we set out to find the best small cities in America. And we wanted to find essentially really livable locales that combine the best of city and suburban life. So when we're talking about small cities, we were looking at places that had a population of 50,000 to 300,000. And what we wanted to find were what we thought were the things that people look for in a great place to live. And we didn't just sort of sit around in a room and think about it ourselves. We did a survey, a nationwide survey, to ask folks, you know, what do you look for in a place to live? What do you most value? And I think the answer wasn't too surprising, but most people said, the majority of people said they wanted lots of job opportunities, good schools, a low crime rate, and lots to do, like arts, leisure, sports, that kind of thing. So that's what we set out to find. And we started very quantitatively and worked with an outside consultant to screen for cities that had all those kind of things.
How much of your assessment, Donna, is objective versus subjective?
Well, I would say that the majority is objective, because we know that different people value different things. So that's why we did this survey. We thought we don't want to just use, you know, we're based in New York. We don't want to just use what people in the, you know, New York or the East Coast want. We wanted a nationwide feel for what people look for. And it's pretty common. I think we all can say that we want to live in a place where there's a lot of jobs and low crime, you know, lots to do and good job opportunities. But to be objective about that, we couldn't just sit around and sort of come up with places ourselves. We used data on a variety of criteria, job growth statistics, violent and property crime rates, education indexes, median home prices, commuting times, and a lot of what we call quality of life indicators, things like the percentage of a population in an area that has health insurance, the density of a population, even the humidity in an area and sunny days versus cloudy days. So we took a lot, you know, just many, many criteria into consideration and use that to come up with what we felt was an objective way to look at these places. But then it becomes subjective at a certain point, because the numbers can only tell you so much. And once we use all this data to screen it and to eliminate certain small cities, we had a list of over 175, and we wanted to come up with, you know, a list of 90. So we started ranking them, and we really spent a lot of time coming up with our top 10. We visited over 24 places in person and started talking to people who live there, who used to live there, people who work in the town, town officials, to really get that kind of feel. And then we went out to more than 24 places ourselves to really get that kind of sense of what a place was like.
Donna, why did you eliminate from consideration all cities with more than 300,000 people? Why was it your quest to focus on small cities?
Money Magazine does this survey each year, and we've done it for more than 20 years. And if you always look at the same criteria each year, the list wouldn't differ too much. So we try to tweak it, you know, from year to year. And we come back, you know, in the past we've done big cities. Last year we did small towns. So we try to look for different criteria each year, because otherwise the list would be boring. It would be very similar every year, at least, you know, year to year. So this year we wanted to find small cities. But I will say the other reason this year, you know, it's sort of a response to, again, what people are looking for. You know, a lot of people go to big cities because there's a lot of jobs there. But one trend that we found was that a lot of people are moving away from big cities, particularly on the coasts, because they're expensive, and a lot of employers are moving out to smaller cities. Some are moving out there because it's cheaper for them to operate, and some are moving out to these areas because that's where people want to live, and so they have a good population. And we find that people are really seeking out places that one expert I talked to are calling the new suburbia. They're independent from what are sort of traditional big cities that you find on the coast, and are really these great, you know, affordable places with shorter commutes and good jobs. And those tended to be small cities.
Well, it's interesting, because I looked at the figures for Naperville, which I think was number 2 or 3 on your list of best places of small towns to live in, or suburbs to live in. And in fact, most people in Naperville are commuting either back into Chicago, which of course Naperville is a suburb of, or they're commuting to surrounding counties, most of them, of course, are commuting back in by rail to Chicago to go to work every day. Clearly, most of the cities on your list, the vast majority of them, are in fact, their well-being is tied to the central city of the region. Sugar Land, Texas, I'm sure, would be the same in terms of its relationship to Houston. So, and if you look at who works in Naperville, as again, I've looked at, there are in fact many people commuting into Naperville to work, and I'm sure that's in part a result, again, of affordability. People who can't afford to work in Naperville but work in the restaurants and the retail shops, et cetera, who commute in. So how do you, I guess, reconcile those facts with this notion of these cities imagined as complete places, as best places to live?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say I have to disagree with you on the sense that we really did focus on cities that had great jobs in them or very close to them. You know, Sugar Land, Texas, which was our number three destination, sure, you know, it always was a suburb of Houston, but there are a lot of energy companies right in Sugar Land or right there that you don't have to go into Houston for. Naperville is another example. Sure, you know, there are people who commute into Chicago. There are people who commute to some of the surrounding suburbs where it's sort of on the technology corridor in Illinois. But, you know, it's also a base, Naperville itself is also a base for a lot of major companies like Tell Labs, ConAgra, OfficeMax, Laidlaw. So we really placed jobs either in that city or right outside that city as a high criteria, and we eliminated places that were great places to live but were really just suburbs of other places. There were a number of towns outside of Philadelphia that were great, had great schools and low crime and, you know, affordable housing, but didn't have any employment opportunities except for in Philadelphia. So we really did emphasize small cities that actually have employment in them. Boise, Idaho, big tech area. Fairfield, Connecticut, home of GE and R.C. Bigelow, the tea maker, which were two other cities on our list. That was really important. So if you take a close look at these cities, you may think of them as places that are close to big cities, and indeed some of them are not that far. Fort Collins is about an hour from Denver. Naperville is only about 40 minutes from Chicago. But these are, you know, and we talk with residents who live there. These were places that they felt that they not only had enough job opportunity in the area that they didn't have to go to that big city, but also there was enough to do in those small cities leisure-wise that they didn't have to leave either.
Mm-hmm. But the numbers still suggest that most of them are commuting out to work every day. Let me ask you, coming back to this objective versus subjective, a recent national study showed that college-educated young adults in the U.S. highly value places that offer them the opportunity to live the life they want to live. Is there anything in your assessment that measures opportunity?
As far as job opportunity?
Well, in fact, this was more than job opportunity. It was the opportunity to live the life they want to live. In fact, that was the second highest sought attribute in this study behind clean and attractive cities. Again, I think in some ways it speaks to your point. There are certain things that are very difficult to measure that are indeed important to how people choose the place they want to live. But I'm curious if there were things that you would like to measure, for instance, that you felt you were unable to do so, things you felt were important, but you just didn't feel like you could measure them accurately.
I would say we did want to measure what we called quality of life indicators, the things that people seek in a place, not just great jobs, but an affordable way to live and having a variety of things to do and a quality of life. But, you know, affordability was a big part of it because, as we all know, in many places, housing costs have gone up. And there may be, you may live in a city that there are great job opportunities, but it's very difficult to afford to live there, particularly for young people. So they find they're spending an enormous amount of their money either on rent or it's impossible for them to even purchase something. So we did take that into consideration, but we also took into consideration what we called ease of living and things like the arts and the leisure, the quality of life, the amount of green space in an area. So we made a very concerted effort not just to look at places with lots of jobs, you know, good schools and low crime, because those places, sometimes you have a lot of places like that that tend to be very expensive, and so they eliminate a lot of people. We purposely eliminated communities where the median home price had a ratio of 7 times or more someone's median income. We didn't want places where people couldn't afford to live.
Let me stop you on that point because it's an interesting point. In fact, doesn't the price of housing reflect the demand for that housing? I mean, isn't there something that suggests that, in fact, it is a best place to live because people want to live there and are driving the housing prices up?
Well, that is true. In last year's list, we had locales that did have, you know, very high prices, and it was there were a number of places that were on the East and West Coast that we ended up having to eliminate because they were just so pricey. People in the past year have felt that home prices have gotten out of control in many desirable locations. And when we looked at places that we thought were best place, we did not choose places that could not be affordable. So if you look at the median home prices for the cities that we chose, they're fairly reasonable. If you look at Fort Collins, our number one, a typical single-family home is $215,000. And, you know, you're paying the, you know, average property tax for a home like that is $1,700. Naperville, which was number two, the typical single-family home, you could buy a home there. The typical one is $360,000, but you could buy, you know, a nice single-family home for less than that as well. Now, that's pricey for the Midwest. But it is not pricey. I mean, there are good jobs around there, and that's probably one of the more expensive places, excuse me, on our list. Mm-hmm. Sugar Land, Texas, number three. You could buy a nice, you know, three-bedroom, two-bath home there for $170,000. So if you look at the median home prices for the cities that we chose and the way we ranked them, you'll see that, you know, these places are affordable. Cary, North Carolina, the typical single-family home, and that's seen a huge influx in population over the past 10 or 15 years, the typical single-family home there is still a median price of $280,000. You tell people that on the coast, they think that's pretty good.
Well, right, but where people are choosing to live gets reflected in higher home prices. I'm thinking about Money Magazine, and of course, a magazine that devotes its content to money and how to make it, how to manage it. Terrific magazine and has been for many years. But I would think that your point of view would be rising home prices. In fact, if they reflect demand in the market, which they would if you believe in a market economy, that might be a good thing.
Sure. You want to be in an area where your home is not going to lose value. And that's why home prices go hand in hand with good schools and job opportunities. You know, I think probably one of the strongest correlations to home prices is job opportunities in an area, which is one reason, you know, the New York housing market has never seen a dip in, despite, you know, recent, the recession, you know, a few years ago and 9/11, because, you know, the job opportunities here continue to be extremely strong. And so that keeps housing prices stable or growing. So that they definitely, you're correct, they definitely go hand in hand. But we purposely set out to find places that were not so unaffordable that people couldn't live there.
Let me ask you one final question. Which large cities made your sidebar list of big cities are good places to live to?
Sure, sure. And we used, you know, some of the same criteria to find our best big cities. And that was sort of fun to do. Our number one was Colorado Springs, which is the base of an Air Force academy. Austin, Texas. I think a lot of people know Austin, but it's known, you know, it's a great tech area, but also has a high quality of life. Mesa, Arizona. A lot of Californians have migrated there. Raleigh, North Carolina, not too far from Cary, which was on our smaller cities list. San Diego, which was kind of well known for its hot housing market, but it's got military and tourism as great bases, but also it's a huge biotech area. Virginia Beach, known for a military town, but also attracting a lot of tech companies, and it's very affordable for homes. Omaha, Nebraska, known for its steaks and Warren Buffett. It's got a really booming downtown. Columbus, Ohio was also on our big cities list, thriving college town, and also Ohio's capital, so a lot of government jobs. Wichita, big aerospace area, and finally New York City. You know, the Big Apple has got the third lowest crime rate among the 25 biggest cities in the U.S. and also a wealth of jobs. But it was number 10 for a reason. It's pretty expensive to live in New York still.
Donna, thanks so much for talking with us about Money Magazine's list of best places to live. We appreciate you being our guest on Smart City.
I really enjoy talking. Thank you.
Donna Rosato is staff writer at Money Magazine. One of the great pleasures of city life is walking. In good cities, there is always something new to discover. Marianne McGinnis is contributing editor of Prevention Magazine, which recently featured walking's related health benefits. Marianne, walking is something all able-bodied people can do, so why don't we?
Well, you know, we just live in a society that tends to promote being sedentary, unfortunately. I think we have way too many sit-down jobs and sit-down activities, and I think it's kind of that law of momentum. When you're still, you want to stay still. But the good news is once you get moving, it's pretty easy to keep on moving.
How far, how fast, how long do you have to walk to make a difference for your health?
Well, we'd love to see people walking about 30 minutes most days of the week. But you can start to make a difference depending on your level just by walking 3 days a week. If you're doing absolutely nothing now, I often start people, and I'm a personal trainer as well as a contributing editor at Prevention, I often start people with just 10 minutes a day, you know, just enough to get them moving. In 10 minutes, that's what we need to get those mood-boosting endorphins released in our brain. So that can be a good enough start to get people feeling good to then add 5 minutes a week and start walking longer and longer.
Marianne, when you say 30 minutes a day, do you mean 30 consecutive minutes a day, or do you mean 3 10-minute bursts? Is there a difference in the benefit to the body in doing it one way or the other?
You know, the scientific research shows that really both ways benefit you. So if you can't do those 30 minutes all at once, it's fine to do 10 minutes at a time, which is really great news for some of us who are so busy. You know, getting 10 minutes after breakfast, 10 minutes at lunch, and 10 minutes after dinner is a lot easier for a lot of folks than squeezing in that 30 minutes all at once.
And the benefits are no different?
You know, as far as the research goes, and there's been a lot done on this, the cardiovascular benefits are still really good. The mood-enhancing benefits are still really good. So, you know, on a personal note, I would love to see people doing those 30 minutes all at once, say 3 times a week, and then if you need to break it up another 3 times a week, that's wonderful.
Is there a trick to keeping up a good pace while you walk?
You know, one of the ones that we love to pass around at Prevention is the Pledge of Allegiance pace test. And what we do is we tell people when they're out walking to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And if they can say it with no problem at all, they're probably walking a little too slow. If they can't even get out 3 words, then they're walking a little too fast. If you can say it but you need to take a pause to catch your breath for every now and then, that's a good indicator that you're walking at a moderate pace. And that's where we want to see you, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being just an all-out sprint and 1 being sitting on the couch. We'd love to see people walking at a 5 or a 6.
Is there a difference you get in the benefits from walking on a treadmill versus on city streets?
You know, both can be really good. There is a difference because, of course, the belt on a treadmill is moving for you. So some research shows that maybe you're burning just slightly less calories, but it's very slight. So really, a lot of times what I'll suggest is that when you're walking on the treadmill, to put the incline up to 2 or 3, so it's just a slight incline, so that kind of makes up for the calorie burn you might lose. And, of course, I think it's a great thing to have as an option. I know here in San Diego, especially lately, it's just been too hot to get out to walk unless you get up at 5 in the morning. So I have been heading to the gym to hop on the treadmill there, and it's a nice alternative. A great idea is to listen to music on the treadmill because that can really keep your energy up as well.
I would have guessed that the benefits to walking on city streets were less than walking on a treadmill. So that's great news for those of us who love cities.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think city walking can be really great. I know I used to go into New York City once a month, and I used to love it there because you really pick up this pace, this fast city walking pace, and you can really get up a good sweat going on those streets.
It is interesting moving with a fast-paced crowd and finding yourself having to pick up the pace. That happened to me recently. I always thought I was a fast walker, but either I'm getting older or my pace is getting slower or people around me are speeding up. I'm not sure which it is. Tell me, what are some of the ways that cities can improve the quality of the experience for walkers?
Sure. Of course, just the physicality of a city can really help. They've done research on the width of sidewalks, and cities that have wider sidewalks really promote walking. It just has a friendlier feel to it, and people get out there more on those wider sidewalks. So you know, if you're looking to move to a place, you might, that might be one of the things you want to check out. Availability of public transportation, which is kind of surprising because you think, well, why would getting on a bus help me walk? But people that use public transportation more walk to the public transportation more often than drive to the public transportation. So that's been shown to really help. Being friendly to dogs, because dog owners are more likely to walk. So a city that's more friendly to dogs that offers, I know Long Beach, close to L.A. here, when you go up to their little city, they have all the little business owners put out bowls of water for the dogs, and there's little doggy bags for you to pick up after your dog on every corner. Those are things that can really encourage people to get out there walking with their dogs.
So do you have advice for those who are still working up their motivation to get started?
Yeah, stop thinking. You know, a lot of times I think we sit and think about all the things we should do. Oh, I should eat healthier. Oh, I should get out and exercise. And just put on those walking shoes and walk out the door and walk around the block just one time. You know, especially, again, for people who are sedentary, start just adding in vacuum at a more vigorous pace. Or when you go out to get the mail, just walk around the block before you come back in. Park farther away from work, an oldie but a goodie, or park farther away when you're going grocery shopping so you have to walk farther into the store, into work. These are all little tricks that can start getting you out there. And I think the biggest trick is that once people get themselves going, they feel so much better, that again, they want to keep going.
Today is a good day for a walk where I am. How about where you are?
Well, it's hot and warm, so again, if it's the middle of the day, I encourage people to look for alternatives if it's just too hot. Malls are great for this. If you have an indoor mall near you, you can go and walk all around, do window shopping while you're doing it, or wait till after dinner, you know, when things cool down and the sun's not right overhead, and get out there. I love getting garden ideas when I walk my neighborhood, so that's another favorite that we do here.
What do you find in terms of the likelihood that someone will walk if one has a partner?
Oh, it's fantastic. The research on doing either weight loss or exercise with a buddy looks wonderful. They're finding things like twice as much weight loss among people that diet and exercise together. So really a good idea. Now, I will say that you should always have an alternative, because I've certainly been in the position where I have a date with somebody and then something comes up and I'm left on my own. But sometimes just knowing that that person is going to meet me is enough to get me out there. So, you know, I think it's great. If you can't get a real person, go for the virtual one. A lot of people have email groups. And I should tell you that prevention.com/walking has a whole introduction to walking buddies, depending on the region that you live with. So if you go there, it's free, and you can just look up for walking buddies anywhere you live.
Taking the name of the magazine, Prevention, literally, I want to ask you, Marianne, what are the two or three best things we can do to prevent illness and keep ourselves healthy?
Well, absolutely. Maintaining a healthy weight, losing weight, and getting regular exercise. Walking is a great example, because research has shown 30 minutes of walking most days a week can extend your life by 1.3 years. So if that's not enough motivation for you, you know, walking's been shown to do everything from reduce risk of cancer, obesity, high blood pressure, cholesterol, and again, reduces the incidence of depression and anxiety. So walking's good for everything from psychological issues to physical issues.
So it's totally within reach if you have an able body. So your message is?
To get out there and start walking. Don't put it off. All you need, it's the best form of exercise, because all you need is a good pair of walking shoes to get out the door.
Marianne, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks so much for having me.
Marianne McGinnis is contributing editor at Prevention Magazine. In Ron Howard's 1985 science fiction movie Cocoon, the principal characters get a new lease on life with the help of some out-of-this-world pods discovered in an abandoned swimming pool. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith examines how baby boomers deal with their feelings and beliefs as they approach old age.
If one thing is true about baby boomers, it's their penchant for making a federal case out of everything that affects them personally. No surprise, then, that in his 2006 State of the Union, President Bush reminded the nation that he is turning 60, and then used that as his segue into a discussion of the unprecedented strains on government to come. For boomers, everything starts with what's happening to them. Indeed, in Bush's words, his 60th birthday was going to be more than unprecedented. It was going to be a quote-unquote personal crisis. The unprecedented strains on the nation? Just a national challenge. Serious, of course, but not a crisis. Now, maybe this is reading too much into Bush's remarks, but whether deliberate or unintentional, there is something telling in the much stronger language used to characterize Bush's 60th birthday than the nation's challenges. Every generation reaches this turning point eventually, but it matters more to baby boomers. Media coverage of the first boomers turning 60 is forcing boomers of all ages to imagine a reality they have long ignored and denied: getting old. Youthfulness has long been the key for understanding boomers. Growing up in a time when youthfulness was celebrated above all else, boomers have had a youthful attitude throughout their lives. Youthfulness involves an active, vigorous questioning of established ways of doing things and a desire for fresh, exhilarating experiences. For boomers, this sense of youthfulness has played out less as a wish to stay forever young and more as a determination not to become old. However, limitations from getting older are unlikely to trouble boomers to the same extent as prior generations. While boomers will have to face up to age-related infirmities, they will benefit from a better quality of life. For the most part, boomers have lived fitter lifestyles than prior generations, with more education and less dangerous occupations. They have smoked less and eaten better diets, albeit with plenty of room for improvement on both counts, and they will continue to benefit from advances in medicine and pharmaceuticals. People always overestimate their risk of disease and debility in old age anyway, so boomers will mature into a period of life that is better than they thought it would be, and that is getting better all the time. Already, today's generation of older Americans enjoys a decade longer health span, or years of active old age, than the generation before them. Baby boomers will enjoy even longer health spans as chronic disability and mortality rates from heart disease and cancer continue to decline. So in facing up to getting old, boomers may well come to believe that old age is not really old, quote-unquote, but is yet another opportunity to live youthful lifestyles. In which case, youthfulness will remain the best way in which to understand and predict the choices of baby boomers. Indeed, this is exactly the future to anticipate, which means that public hand-wringing notwithstanding, the bottom line on boomers is a generation getting older, not old. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archived shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.